Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm good.
Why are you good?
I've just landed from Gothenburg in Sweden.
All right. What was you doing in Gothenburg in Sweden, Rob?
I was there for Tori Rones, the Norwegian performance artist and sculptor. Mm. And she had a major museum show at the Gothersborg Kunstmuseum, which is like a bit like the Tate, but in Gothenburg, and it's a huge building. She had a floor-to-ceiling film installation, which I loved, and it was brilliant.
She's a performance artist, she said.
Yeah, and
did she perform?
She did a little kind of, it wasn't an official performance, but she did a welcome song, kind of improvised. They had a microphone where they were doing speeches, and she just walked up and started singing, and it was unbelievable, and she got a recorder out and started playing with the recorder.
Wow.
I mean, I think it was slightly planned, because actually she did have like a voice machine thing that made her voice sound like five.
What was the song like? Can you give us a version of it?
No, but if you go to my personal Instagram, you'll be able to see a video of her.
Ah, okay.
I had a great few days there, catching up with Tori.
Yes.
And now I am in the studio in London with you.
And?
With a very special guest.
This guest is incredibly exciting. I have made, like, pages and pages of notes, which is something I don't normally do.
No, but I always make notes, but I have them as, like, a digital file. But you've gone really old school and you have paper.
Well, I've been...
But it's an
There's a rustle on the mic.
Classic. you were waiting for that.
It's all about timing.
It is. It's incredible timing. I've fallen into a rabbit hole of YouTube videos because this man has done a lot of presenting and interviews that are readily available on YouTube, and it's incredibly fascinating. I'm hooked. I'm a huge fan, and I am bedazzled by him. And
well, he's a conceptual artist.
Yep.
He was made an OBE in 2017.
Wow.
So we have another OBE here because we had
too many OBEs.
So many OBEs
in
this room.
Get over it.
And the thing for me, which I connect so strongly with his work, is this idea of the power of imagination and kind of the possibility that we all are creative, even if we're not all artists as such. We have this potential to imagine, and just like when you're a kid, you can think up all these wonderful ideas and do them. And it even got me thinking about this podcast, how you and I are being creative ourselves, you know, and it's like we can't help ourselves but to create.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to be with him today.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Well, let's welcome OBE.
Ryan Gander.
Oh, yeah.
How you doing?
It's like watching ping pong between you two.
Yeah,
is
right.
It?
From side to side.
Do you think it's like an Olympic sport?
Can it be tennis, not
bracketed
ping pong? Ping pong's a bit light.
Yeah. What?
Bracketed by two athletes.
Yes,
I was an athlete, sadly. Not so much. Do you know what? The other thing I wanted to say is I love your spoken voice.
Yes.
Like, I think you have the best voice.
Yes.
And I was watching some of the videos last night, because actually I did all the research reading sort of press releases and text. I didn't realise you'd done all this presenting stuff until yesterday. But you have the most amazing voice.
It's why they put Northerners on telesales, because you're more likely to buy stuff, because we're really friendly.
Love that.
It's a trustworthy voice,
apparently,
isn't it?
Yeah. Although I just had four friends come to Suffolk for the weekend, some school friends. And everyone, wherever we went to pubs and stuff. And everywhere we went, everyone looked like we were going to rob them.
Really?
Yeah.
What, they were worried that you guys were just like a little gang?
It's quite posh Suffolk.
Right.
And four lads and...
But you're from Suffolk, aren't you?
No, Chester.
Oh, Chester.
Yeah, but...
Right.
Chester.
Okay. Makes sense.
My auntie Fran lives in Chester.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and all my cousins.
Auntie Fran lives there.
Yes, hi, Auntie Fran. And she actually listens to this podcast.
Hello, Auntie Fran.
Yeah.
Like, do you know where she lives in Chester?
She's terrified now.
I'll try and think about it and get back to you on that.
Give us her exact address.
She was a school teacher, though. She was like a head teacher at a school.
Which one?
I'll find out for you.
Great.
Get me the details.
Yes, I will do.
You need to know them.
Yeah. Nantwich.
No.
Is Nantwich Chester?
It's close. Oh, yes. Cheshire, isn't
it? Nantwich. I got there in the end. She's from Nantwich. They live in Nantwich, and she was the teacher at a primary school in Nantwich, or a, you know, a young kid's school.
This is fascinating.
There you go.
So,
yeah.
Your answer aside. Ryan, so we have got you here today, and it's incredibly exciting because I've been trying to pinpoint you down, and you're an artist that, and it's been said everywhere, you're an artist who can't be pinpointed down to one style because you avoid a recognisable style and you thrive in that role.
It's funny because people really like recognising things, don't they? It makes you feel comfortable. And so you don't do very well commercially and you're not if you're not recognisable. So it's a bit like a contradiction or a bad curse to keep changing what you do. But I just get too bored, I think, if I did the same thing all the time. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. You quoted, so to quote a quote, you quoted that Picasso said that himself, he didn't have a recognisable style. Style was like the disease of the artist. But yet, in retrospect, we all can see now that Picasso completely had a style.
I think Picasso's style was him. I don't think the drawings and paintings and ceramics and that were actually the artwork. I think his persona, which he constructed, was the artwork. And all the art that we think of being as art is just like the offcuts and the byproducts and
or the receipts,
the fallout, of him being Picasso. I think it was a master plan.
So you think, are you saying that because you're a conceptual artist and you can look from a conceptual artist's point of view and look at him and go, well, he was conceptual and all of that stuff was, the journey was taken and this is what was shown to us. But actually, Picasso himself was the concept.
Yeah, I mean, if you close your eyes and you think about Picasso, come on.
All right, we're closing.
Okay, I'm closing my eyes.
I'm thinking of him.
Think of Picasso. You're not seeing his work, are you?
No,
you see
it's
a picture of him in his
striped shirt,
baggy jumper,
yeah.
Or him dressed as a cowboy, holding a baguette, holding an umbrella for Jacqueline or someone.
Yeah, one of them.
So you see images of him.
That's interesting. That's also the same with Dali, isn't it?
It is.
You think of Dali and you see him. You don't really necessarily go to the painting.
But most artists that do well and become historically significant, they have a strong identity, don't they, when you think about it?
Do you think you've got a strong identity?
God.
I do.
You think you've got a strong identity?
I think you've got a strong identity.
I don't know. I don't know if I have or not.
Well, my point is, in retrospect, do you think people...
That's not my masterwork in a way, but I recognise it as other people's.
Do you have the master plan? Do you think your legacy will be that people will look back at you and say, oh, he did have a style, because actually looking back at his career, now we can pinpoint everything?
I'll be totally honest with you. I'm a control freak when it comes to art. And I'm like, I work really, really hard and I need to control everything and understand how people read things and the approachability of things and second guess every move like a massive game of chess. But in terms of legacy and in terms of my practice or artist persona, I just don't construct anything. I think the reason that I started doing art in the first place is because I didn't want to get a job, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's more of what I didn't want to do rather than what I did want to do. Mm-hmm. My dad worked at Vauxhalls. I remember he said to us once, it's an old cheesy cliche, but if you choose a job that you love, you never work a day in your life.
Yeah,
and I mean... So I started making art and then I'd look at artists and I'd see artists making the same work again and again and again. And I was like, this is quite like working at Allied Carpets, which is what I did for a bit, like doing the same thing every day. And that's not what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I just tried to construct a practice that would chop and change.
And for everyone listening who might not be familiar with your work already, you or the media that you've worked across includes things like sculpture, even writing text, posters, radio plays, prints, making new fonts, making paintings that no one will actually ever get to see because you destroy the paintings, but you leave the palette used with the paint on it. Mm-hmm. Scripts, you've made like adverts, kind of government, you know, adverts that look like they're made by the government, publishing books, a chess set, clothes, like it's
trainers,
just endless.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's funny because those things are actually within the remit of art, but I do other things as well, like make telly programs for telly.
Yeah.
And I have a company called Otto Motto, which is a design company, which, you know, Tony Chambers, who used to be the editor of Wallpaper, it's a company that I have with him. Mm. We're launching a kitchen sink in Milan in a couple of weeks. So it's actually broader than art.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in a way, leading a creative life, it doesn't matter if it's art or it's design or if it's kids' toys, or it doesn't matter what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be anything. So it's just about keeping busy.
Of course.
Keeping out of trouble.
What's the sink going to be like?
Oh, God, if I told you that, you might...
Oh, really?
It's...
Are we all going to want the sink?
That's the plan.
Got it.
Russell's only asking this because he's obsessed with, like, interiors.
New house.
Now you've mentioned a sink, he's like, ding!
Exactly.
It's based on the principles of Kappo cooking, which originates from Okayama in Japan, where right. the chef cooks any type of food in, like, a whole host of different methods, but just one chef in one kitchen, and he's visible. So they have a sink that is also the worktop and also incorporates bowls and things. That's really utilitarian.
Wow.
And the Otto Motto, the name of the company, is a bit of a play on a Japanese word, but anglicized, that means close at hand. So that gives you a bit of an idea what it's like. Basically, the kitchen moves around you rather than you walking around the kitchen. So
it's like you, it's like everything.
Yeah, exactly.
You're covering all bases one thing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And do you speak Japanese?
No.
But you spend a lot of time there?
Yeah, I've been like a lot. I go twice a year and I've been going for like 10 years. So wow. Most of my work's in Japan, like probably 70% of stuff I've made's in Japan. Stuff I've made that's sold.
Why do you think the Japanese are into your work so much?
I don't know. I've thought about it loads because it is a bit of a mini phenomenon that there's so much work there. I don't know. I think when you look at Shinto culture, Shinto, you know, the religion, Shintoism, there's this obsession with kami, which is the soul of objects, that all objects have their own soul and they have a backstory and a meaning, a history and a legacy, and that they exist without people and that they will outlive people. When people die, they still exist in the world.
Even if they're man-made or if they're natural objects.
Yeah, so leaves, trees, rocks, cups, anything really.
Yeah.
And when you think about that in relation to conceptual art, it's the same kind of idea, isn't it? It's the same equation. Because in conceptual art, the object isn't really the artwork, it's the story. So the object is a vessel for telling a story. Mm. So it's got a similar... it might be just that, I don't know.
And talking about that idea of the story
and
the journey to sort of making the artwork, which I've heard you, like Russell mentioned earlier, you describe it often as a receipt, and it's not actually what interests you, the end result. The getting there is the interesting bit.
The story of getting there, yeah.
Talking about Japan, isn't there a story with the watch? Are you wearing it right now, the watch?
I'm wearing, yeah.
You that are? One. Oh, that's the one. Wow.
It's a triumph.
So the watch you're wearing is technically an artwork, and it's from 2011, is that right?
It's good it's an artwork because then you insure it in your art insurance rather than your...
So cool.
on your personal insurance, yeah. It works out cheaper. Don't tell the insurance company. It's a massive scam.
Oh, no, but it's true. It is an artwork.
No, I had a show at Hermes in Ginza in Tokyo and there was a big sculpture there.
What, Hermes is in the designer brand?
Yeah, they have an art space there in Ginza.
Right.
Like, really nice space.
Is that the only one in the world they have, or do they have one?
I think they have a space in Paris as well, a gallery, yeah.
I didn't know. Did you know that?
It's an art centre.
I know they've done things in the actual store as well. They've done, like, collaborations with artists.
Windows.
In the window.
Like, Louis Vuitton did it, or is it the same?
Before. I think Hermes were before, actually.
All right.
Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
There was a big sculpture there, and there's... a guy there called Masamichi Katayama, who owns a company called Wonderwall. So he's done Uniqlo in New York,
wow.
and Broadway and stuff like that. He's an interior designer.
Right.
And he's a friend of mine and he collects my work. And he was saying he liked this sculpture. And at that moment, at the opening, I was just thinking, shit, how am I going to get this sculpture back home? And how am I going to pay to store it? Because it's massive. No one's going to buy it.
How did you get it over there in the first place? Or was it constructed there?
It was sent there on their budget. But then it was, you know, all the shipping costs and storage costs that you accumulate with physical possessions. And he was saying, oh, I'd love to have it. How much is it? And I said, oh, just you can give it. I knew he had this Bamford Rolex that was limited edition, a black one. And I said, just give us your watch and you can have it, flippantly as a joke. I wasn't really proposing it.
Yeah.
And he just took it off and said, yeah. I was like, this is unreal,
so
isn't it?
Good.
Yeah. What was the sculpture?
It was, you know, on the Seine in Paris, you get those book vendor stalls that open up and they're attached to the wall.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of those, but it was one of the Alchemy Box series, which is their artworks that are containers that look like something else with a load of stuff inside and the real artworks inside. But the things that are inside are listed on the wall.
But you can never open it.
Yeah, you can never open it. And the idea is you construct your own artwork out of the ingredients listed that are inside it.
Well, that's so you. A lot of your work is activated by the public, is activated by people imagining. You like the idea of people projecting onto your work their own creative ability, right?
Yeah, because everyone's creative, aren't they?
So you're kind of facilitating the public's creativity by your work. It's very giving and generous.
The thing about the world is it's amazing and people are really scared to show enthusiasm about all the amazing things in it. It's almost like art is pretentious, you know? It's there's a stigma attached to being enthusiastic about things that are non-mainstream, maybe, you know?
Of course. But it's only with maturity, and I've found that it's only... Like, I'm a geek. Rob's a geek. But when you're younger, you can't... Well, maybe in the next generation they do, but you could never admit to being a geek. Like, I was a collector, or I like this, or I like that, but I've never really admit it at school.
Yeah, but you know, when we did the first podcast, you said, like, we used to geek out and stuff, and I almost took offence to begin with. I was like, I'm not a geek, and then I was like, oh my God, I'm a geek.
Yeah,
and
we're geeks.
Now I'm totally fine with
maturity,
it. I feel like I've embraced my geekness by doing this
podcast.
Exactly,
but that's with maturity, is that you own being a geek, and you think, well, I'm old enough to just know who I am, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But when you're younger, you're fearful of letting people know that you're not mainstream, that you have other thoughts and you have other enthusiasms. As I got older, I thought, don't apologise for enthusiasm. There's nothing better in the world than that. And to support a kid's interests is like the best thing in the world. And that's what your work is kind of letting people have.
Well, I guess it's kind of tricking them in to being geeks. And then when they realise they are and it didn't feel so bad, maybe they embrace it themselves and carry on. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
So if you give, like, put a big worm on the hook.
Yeah.
As something intriguing or seducing visually or cognitively, and then they get into it, and then they're like, oh God, I'm standing in an art gallery.
Yeah.
And I've always been scared to go in these. I'm really enjoying myself.
Yeah, amazing. But, and you've got, you say an analogy of art galleries is that people, you're making people take notice, basically. You want people to notice stuff. And in an art gallery, you're programmed, you walk into an art gallery, and you notice everything because you are in a white space, and that's what you've been told and programmed that that's what you do in the art gallery. But then when you leave and you go on the streets, there's incredible things that you should notice, but you just you're not programmed to notice them. Yeah. And you,
it's like the art gallery is a massive highlighter pen of the world. You know, the things that are taken in there just makes them visible.
Yeah.
But I think, like, the real quality of a good artist is seeing things in the world. You know, I mean, it's the only thing that I'm any good at, I think. Is if you go for a walk with me, people get frustrated because I stop every 2 minutes to look at something, like chewing gum on the pavement, and take photos of it.
You take
just because I'm, I guess I'm wired to do that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's also like when I was a kid, I was in hospital a lot. Mm-hmm. So because I use a wheelchair, and I had the bone disease, so I spent a lot of time like in hospital in bed. Mm. And when you're not in the world, you crave for the world, I think.
Mm.
And then you imagine the world. And when you imagine the world, it's like taking your brain to the gym, isn't it? It's just like a muscle that gets better at what it does.
So. Is it ever too much? Do you ever find that you have to kind of chill out on that?
Yeah.
You do?
It's too much in my studio because I collect a lot of stuff and I collect a lot of photographs that are then printed and put in filing boxes. Mm-hmm. So it's like going to some mad murderer's basement where they've, you know, with the maps and all that stuff.
Yep.
Where they've, my office in the studio is a bit like that, which is horrible, really.
But you need to archive stuff like that to have bring order to what you're seeing around you, because otherwise it would just be too much information. Or
I do that because it's all in the back part, the storage of my brain. I think all these ideas and things and starting points and catalysts and. But the RAM, the bit at the front that just keeps you going, you can't keep it all at the front.
No.
So you need these keys to, you know, remind you of things, to the stimulus of seeing a word or seeing a photograph to remember the stuff that's in the back, just to keep it all in the front of my mind, really.
Do you ever feel an instinct to repeat something you've done and you have to stop yourself? Or are you normally like pretty good at doing it, that's done, next idea?
That's exactly the way I do
it. Really?
Really?
So you've never felt inclined? It's a whole, like the palettes, I guess, was a whole thing that was...
Yeah, I kept doing those because people kept getting married and they were great wedding presents.
Oh, right. And the lamps. The lamps is an ongoing
thing. And the lamps
thing.
Is another one.
Is that ongoing?
They're like thank you presents and wedding presents. They're great to make people lamps out of, old toilet seats and stuff.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. And you still make them?
I haven't made a lamp in ages. I've got a box with some bits in because I promised to make my dad one, but I haven't got around to doing it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about your dad then, if we're on to that.
Yeah, I love the fact that family plays such a big role
in your
world.
Your dad is your hero.
Dad's in it.
Your dad's your hero. I mean, and he features
so much.
I know, but
your dad had so many great sort of quotes that you...
Yeah, let the world take a turn.
Yeah.
What age was that when he said that to you?
I think he said that it must have, five, six, around, when I was really young.
And that's quite profound. And what did you take it to mean?
You know the moments where, something bad happens on your email and you respond straight away?
Yeah.
And then the moment you've pressed send, leg it for the Ethernet cable to rip it out the wall.
Yeah.
And you think, God, I just wish I'd waited till tomorrow.
Just put it in drafts and read it.
It's about taking perspective on things, isn't it? Let the world take a turn. If you look at something from a different time, it's a different perspective. So, yeah. I mean, we need more of that at the moment. The world's gone mad, hasn't it?
Yes, it's quick thinking.
Yeah. And we just lack so much empathy. The last decade feels like it's empty of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
So if everyone let the world take a turn, I think we'd all be a lot happier.
Yeah, slowing down.
Yeah.
And kind of, we were talking...
instantly judging everything, you know?
Totally.
Outrage. You want instant outrage.
Yeah.
Clickbait.
We spoke with John Stesica the other week about stillness and about trees and art, trees in art. And I love all that idea as well of slowing everything down.
Yeah.
It's something that as I'm getting older, I've realised you sort of really need to do. It's really
important.
It does
that. How old are you?
I'm 38.
Oh, so
you look older.
How old are you?
37.
I look older.
The eldest one here.
Oh.
No, impossible.
How old's the sound recorder?
But you're dressed the youngest.
Oh, for you in there, in that window.
He's 25.
Fuck off.
Wow.
Right. He's only 25.
Stay in the other room.
But your dad's your hero, isn't he?
Yeah, dad's my hero.
And he features in so much of
I've
your work.
I've got lots of heroes, but he's one of them.
Oh. But there's a beautiful story where he took the... For you and your friends to make art, he cleared out the garage.
Yeah, the garage. I love that story.
Where did you hear that?
You spoke about this, yeah. You've done it in interviews before.
You have spoke about your work a lot.
That's amazing.
It is all out there.
Actually, I know where it is. It's Miranda Sawyer.
Oh, yeah.
She went back to your home and you walked outside the house and she pointed at the house and you were like, that's the garage where it began.
That was such a beautiful story for your dad to allow your creativity at that age.
Yeah.
And he helps you make the lamps.
Yeah. Yeah, he came to the studio and... Terrible. It's better than child labour though, isn't it? Getting your dad in. Got my children working for us, so that's good.
Yeah, but actually your children have played a really big part in your work. And one of my favourite things you've ever actually made was a sculpture, which is a cast of a den that your daughter had made, and even has the kind of like paint pot that she might have, had underneath the sheet. And it brought back all of these memories for myself. It's such a powerful thing, this idea of making a den. And somehow when you're a child and you're kind of trying to work out what the world means and what home means and then playing and inventing situations.
I think what that's characteristic of is... I try to make work that's a bit universal. So when you think about shelter, it's a universal thing, isn't it? It's like every human in the world needs shelter. It's something we all totally understand. And then talking about how old we are and time slowing and empathy, time and the anxiety, the influence that we play in the world, or mortality and the fear of death, they're all universal subjects as well. And I think it's good to make art about things that are universal rather than specific. I'm not into making work about my specific position in the world,
But that's also your gallerist, Listen Gallery, Nicholas Logsdale. In one of the interviews I heard with him, he was saying that he thinks that's the reason you're so globally successful, is because the sculptures you make, the artworks you make, all the different stories, even, they are all so universal.
Every man.
It doesn't matter what language you speak, you can actually still relate to it. Like your rock of the Thinker's Rock.
Yeah.
Like that work, you know, goes off to Japan and then they respond to it in the same. It's a kind of, you sort of pinpoint these experiences that we all share, regardless of language, which is super powerful, actually. And hard
It's visual language, isn't it? Yeah. So when you, I mean, it shouldn't be bound by, visual language isn't bound by nuance, is it? It's bound by universality. So it, you know, I think all communication, whether it's visual language or you know, written language, spoken language, all of semiotics is based in articulation of things, of universal signs. It's not based in localized stories. They're all the good works when you look at the history of art. They're all the things that are universal. So,
and history of art is really important to you, and where you play into that.
It's like a mountain, isn't it? History of art.
Yeah, go on.
And I'm trying to be a mountaineerer.
And whereabouts are you on the mountain?
Just at the base camp. With no oxygen tanks. Just looking up longingly. No, but it is a bit like that, because you follow, I think all artists also follow footprints and then go off at a tangent.
Mm-hmm.
So the history of art is, it's laying out a map for thinking, because there's no point redoing the work of Solowit, is there?
No.
He's done it. So you go to where Solowit went to, and you pick up the first aid kit he dropped and the adrenaline in his rope, just keying into the mountaineering reference.
Oh, yes, I've got it. Right. I was thinking, did he make them worse? Right, yeah, go on.
And then you,
so is he, but is he on one of your reference points then?
Well, yeah, but there's hundreds.
Who are your top ones?
Changes at the moment. Bruno Minari, designer, Italian designer.
Yeah.
Made a lot of children's toys and things like that. A lot of graphic design. He actually made the first mobiles before Calder, and then Calder made mobiles, and Calder's ended up selling for millions and hanging in art.
Did he do stabiles as well, or were they just all the mobiles?
No, just the mobiles.
Right.
And he did, but he made his out of card and gave them to friends to hang above cots of their kids. And
wow.
And would Calder have seen them, do you think?
Yeah, totally. Wow. But I love all those stories in the history of art. There's a great one about Mondrian and Theo van Doesburg, you know, with the, well, van Doesburg made basically Mondrian's work, but at a 45-degree angle. So on a diagonal with all the lines beefed up in bold. It's a bit like a conceptual art, because it's a bit of a riff or a piss take of history. Or, but they were friends and they played chess together, and they, you know, and then when Mondrian saw it, he thought he was, you know, having the piss taken out of him. So he didn't talk to van Doesburg ever again, which is great, because, you know, that might happen now if you slept with someone's wife or something, but this was like the dynamic aspect of a diagonal line. It wasn't anything to get upset about.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Very passionate about their lines, obviously.
Of course they are.
Yeah.
And what about like ready-made champions like Duchamp and...
Yeah, Breitard's Duchamp, or, I mean, they're the masters for me.
One person that inspired you that I was really excited by to discover last week was that Russell and I love Willow Road.
Oh,
in Hampstead, and you actually did an exhibition there.
Yeah,
and I live literally down the road from there, like 2 minutes from down there. So I go there quite a lot, and I didn't realise you'd done a show there.
Yeah.
But I loved that show you did.
Yeah.
I looked at all the works you put in it, including a chess set. And he also is somebody that made many different things, including toys or different.
Yeah, he was good. He was meant to be a bit grumpy though. I don't know if he was grumpy. I never met him, obviously. But I wrote a children's book about Erno and Trellick Tower about when was it? 2002. It's a long time ago. And then, yeah, just became a bit obsessed with him from then. I'm doing a project now, which is a door handle, which is Goldfinger's pipe.
Oh, wow.
So when you go to Willow Road, on his desk, there's a load of pipes. Mm-hmm. He used to make the pipes, and one of them's a straight one rather than the curly one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same proportion as a door handle.
Oh, that's so
good. So we're making this run of bronze.
This is with your company as well, that you're making the sink.
I've not decided whether it's with that or it's a work.
We're going to outsource
it. Yeah, whether it's an artwork or whether it's a...
Well, I've got my door handle sorted and my sink.
I actually have a hook in my flat in London, designed by him.
Erno.
Designed by Erno.
Oh, is it the plastic one with the two
little nipples? Yeah, the plastic one with the two kind of...
That's Michael Marriott's.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, called Erno.
Oh, I thought it was designed by Erno Golfing.
Yeah, no,
I got that wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, it's inspired by him.
Yeah.
Oh, I got that completely wrong.
Oh, God.
I bought it at
the house.
He
probably didn't have any plastic.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
No, he probably did, but didn't like it.
Yeah.
Only use concrete.
We love concrete.
And wood.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Talking about concrete, you worked with a really incredible type of concrete for the Baltic, which lights up at night time.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Nightcrete.
Nightcrete.
Yeah, the company's up there in Tyneside that sort of invented it, and it glows in the dark.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Because that was all about darkness.
They were 10 inventions that were invented in the north of England.
Yeah.
And then I minimalised them, made them very simplified them and abstracted them. And then they became, and put them on chains. I mean, but they're huge, you know, they're like, each one's the same size as this recording studio.
And each of those inventions are historically significant, but they all involve light, creating light.
They all give light.
Yeah, like sources of light.
Which is a bit of a play on enlightenment, isn't it? Or to illuminate, or to show someone something, or to, yeah.
And you cast those in night.
They're in nightcrete, so they absorb the light in the day and then they glow at night. And they were,
is that what that's called?
Yeah.
I saw an Urs Fischer table that he made that was a glow in the dark.
Glowed in dark.
It's incredible. And you put objects on it, and then when you take them off at night, because the light that's blocked it there, you can see the objects like shaped out
that's
on the
so
table.
Cool.
It's so
that's
cool.
Nice.
That's called nightcrete.
Yeah.
That's so sci-fi.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about how important you are. So you're an OBE, and we brushed over that, but let's really delve into that. That happened in 2012.
No,
2017.
Oh, God. 2017 is really recent.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Was you prepped for that letter?
It was... No, God.
Did it just appear in the post, or what?
No, it was on holiday in Dubai.
Right.
I was on holiday in Dubai.
Yeah.
I was on the beach.
Holiday, yeah.
I've just been to Lanzarote on a package holiday.
Yeah, and?
I felt right at home.
Good, yeah. My parents have got a place in Tenerife.
Have they?
Yeah.
There was little Heinz ketchup sachets in the pool.
Oh, in the pool?
It's a bit grim.
But that's quite lucky if you've taken chips in the pool with you.
I'm surprised that hasn't inspired an artwork. It sounds like quite a genius work.
I was taking notes.
Did you photograph them?
Yeah, you did.
So what? How?
Don't know. Got a phone call from someone that opened a
in
letter.
Dubai.
Someone said at the studio, "There's a letter from the Queen. Do you want me to open it?" Wow. And I was like, "You better open it. Yeah, if it's from the Queen, because it says on the outside, doesn't it? This is from the Queen."
The Queen. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And then she said, "You're going to be an OBE if you want to accept it." And I was like, "Yeah,
fuck yeah."
My mum's going to be well happy.
Yeah, of course.
And then lots of people say no, don't they? I didn't even think about it. I just said, "Yeah, take anything, me."
Well, if they're not royalists, I guess.
Well, no, that's not actually technically true. Some people say no, not lots of people, because loads of people get OBEs, don't they?
Yes, like, a lot of people turn down knighthoods and damehoods.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah. They
fair
do.
Enough.
Yeah.
I think you should just accept it.
I did.
Well, he did.
Well done.
In 2017, he's got it. What are the perks of being an OBE, Ryan Gander?
Well, there's the old BA executive.
Oh, tell us about that.
You know, your gold card.
You said you were listening to...
Michael Craig Martin said that he put Sir... Because he's knighted, he's above me.
Yeah,
I'm lowly in comparison to that.
Can you get knighted after an OBE?
I hope so.
Yeah, of course you can. Because Michael was an OBE.
Oh,
then he got. Then he got a CBE. Then he got knighted.
And
you've got all this to come, Ryan. Keep
that's
it going.
A slow
keep
lad keep that's
designing,
climbing, isn't it? One by one,
keep designing kitchen sinks.
Does it eradicate when you pump up to the next one? Does the next one just the one below just disappear?
No, you keep it. You're then
that's
CBE, OBE.
Letters, isn't it?
Take your ages.
CBE, OBE.
I did that thing that everyone says you should do, where you call BA Executive Club and say, for your air miles and that, you say, it's actually OBE. And they did it, and then I arrived for a flight to Germany. Mm. And on the ticket it said Ryan Ganderobe instead of Ryan Gander, because they'd done it as one word.
So
and they wouldn't
good.
Let me board the plane because it didn't match.
Oh, no.
It's a nightmare.
So what, did you miss the flight?
No, I talked them round and they changed it, but it took ages.
That should be one of your clothing lines, Ganderobe.
Ganderobe.
Yeah, it could be like nightgowns that I could then hang just on my Erno Goldfinger-inspired hook.
Are there Medidas trainers out there then? The ones with the...
They are. I haven't seen a pair for a while because I did them, they were a few years ago. They get dirty, don't they? And then people put them back in the box.
Did they appear as a hashtag on Instagram? Did they go sort of viral for a while?
Yeah.
And do you wear them?
I've just done a prototype for a tracksuit for Adidas, but I don't think they're going to do it.
Why?
Because I didn't think about it at the time, but it encourages theft. It's like, you know those tags that you get in shopping centres that explode when you break them off?
And the red, bloody ones.
Ink on them. So it's an all-white tracksuit that... I put them through that process so they become like these abstract paintings and each one's completely unique and different.
Oh, wow.
But they look like they've been robbed, which is also kind of funny.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they can exist in the gallery instead if they're not being mass produced.
There was a design this year who put tags...
Having the tags on.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
That were like kind of like security tags.
You're getting stopped.
Yeah, exactly. If you're going in and out of stores with them, but... Yeah.
I didn't see that.
I was on... Talking about that, I was on a flight recently. There's a private aeroplane. I don't normally. This is part of this is why the story works. I wouldn't normally talk about that, but anyway, and we were going through security, and then this girl went through, and she went in through with these new boots, and the security guard suddenly stopped after went for the X-ray machine, went completely white, and said to her, "Should I run now or not?" And she went, "What do you mean?" He said, "Your boots. Should I run now?" And she's like, "Why should you run now?" He said, "You have two computers in the soles of both of your boots. Why have you got computers in the soles of your boots?" And she went, Oh no, they're heaters. They're USB things. They're self-heating boots. And he was like, they look like bombs.
Oh.
And she was like, fuck.
My God.
So then she had to ring up the label and say, people, if they're not flying private and they're just going to go through JFK with these, they're going to get bundled into a room and interrogated.
That's crazy.
These look like shoe bombs.
Yeah. I've never heard of heated shoes either.
It's a new thing. And you plug them in your USB and it heats up your boot and you can turn it on and your feet are warm.
Wow.
Bit needy, isn't it?
just put another pair of socks on. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
It's obviously someone who flies private.
Yeah.
Can I quickly segue
a friend parenthesis?
Can I segue back into an art story?
Oh. I like another segue as a doing word. What
thank
is it
you,
a noun?
Thank you.
Verb? I don't know.
Adjective.
I will segue.
I don't know.
I segue. An artwork I really love that you made was about the inner sole of your shoe. I love this idea.
It was made of meat.
So many artworks that I don't know. What
you do know it. It's one of the colliding ones.
It's the way that collide,
and it has the inner sole, like a sole that you put inside
your
shoe.
Made of wood, though.
It is made of wood.
Yeah,
but I love that piece. Can you explain what those works?
That was
about,
in Goldfinger's house.
They're all wooden carvings.
Yeah,
but they were two things that collide. So you know the way in the world everything associates with one another. So if you think of it, you sit in a pub with some friends and you start talking. And whatever you start talking about can associate with anything else.
Mm-hmm.
That's just human nature. Mm. So the idea was to get two objects you couldn't associate, which is impossible, but a really great sort of mental agility exercise.
Oh.
And then I put them together and they're carved as one piece from the same piece of wood. So you can see the tree, that it's a singular tree that's...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where do you find the craftsmanship for that?
The craftsman is in Deptford.
Lovely.
In a
tree.
He's
house.
Canadian.
All right.
Yeah.
Great.
I really love.
Born in the forest, raised by wolves.
Love him.
I really love this idea, though, that like the inner sole of your shoe is something that no one else would ever use, because it's not like you take a pair of shoes and be like, oh, even if they were secondhand and you were going to use them, you're not going to keep the inner sole in that somebody else has used, because it's such a kind of incredibly personal thing.
Yeah.
And I love that intensity.
A lot of them are personal. There's another one which is, you know, the Swiss USM cabinets, the posh Swiss cabinets that are dead expensive. One of those with a knotted used condom on the top.
Exactly.
So they're types of things that you never
would share,
think about, or share.
Yeah.
You'd never
it's a knotted condom.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd never use that again.
Knotted nodder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but it's true that they're kind
of... They don't exist for very long, because I imagine they go in the bin pretty rapidly.
But they're kind of objects that, you're right, you almost don't think about consciously.
Exactly.
Because you kind of, you don't think about your inner soul.
They're like temporary objects, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
With life expectancy.
So in your brain, you have all of these, you're constantly, it's actually almost like when you're a kid and you're looking out the window of the car and you're like, what's that? What's that? What's that? That's what I imagine it's being like with you walking on the street. You're like, what's that? What's that? But for someone who has that kind of attention to tiny details around you, you obviously have to set up rules or limitations or boundaries within what you do in order for it to then somehow... for you to actually be able to create.
To manifest.
And some of the, like Martin Creed also spoke about that, having to build fences and as a way for him to be able to contain his ideas and then create an artwork. So I do understand that in other practices as well. But with you, you've done things like where you actually pretend you're a different artist.
Yes.
So you're almost like acting. Can you explain like how that all came about? Because I've never thought
I've
about
actually
that
stopped doing that now because...
Have you?
It was so mentally tiring and just made you feel quite weird.
Yeah.
And
would you get into a mindset then of these people?
Yeah, well, that was the exercise really, which is problematic, isn't it? Because you end up being slightly schizophrenic, I guess. I mean, you're putting your mind through a lot of stress by pretending to be six different people.
Yeah, so you were actually creating works as if you were somebody else.
You were Spencer Anthony was one guy, wasn't it?
There's Abbe Faria, Maria Rory, Vivi Enkia.
Santo
Irving
was the
Green,
shit artist, didn't you?
Santo was the bad guy.
Yeah, all right.
Well, not the bad guy. He just didn't operate by, artistically operate by my ethics and morals. And
but you said whenever you got a bad idea, you would, Ryan would never make it, but Santo would make this piece of shit art, which you would never make.
Yeah, all artists have that, don't they? That's the worst thing I think about being an artist is that you go to a big museum and you see a work that is exactly what you thought at once. At one time you thought you could make,
right,
but you've dismissed it because you thought it would be a terrible idea, and it's actually been validated by the art world. That's like, that's the dagger, isn't it?
Oh,
people actually like it.
What are you proudest of? What is your proudest art creation?
God, that's hard.
Thank you.
God,
that's talk art.
Okay.
Welcome to talk art.
$1 million question. Uh-huh. It's probably the piece at Documenta where it was just the breeze in the gallery, where it was just...
Oh, wow.
Because people still come up... You know, artists sometimes are known for one work.
Yes.
And like Tracy in the bed,
but
she can never
piece.
Never escape it in a way, you know. I guess.
Well, Martin Creed is lights on, lights off.
Yeah, that's, exactly,
yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a bit. I've always worried that would
define.
Yeah, be my downfall in terms of being defying expectation because it's something that people come up to us even now, like 8 years later, and say, oh my God, that piece was amazing.
Tell us about it.
It's basically, well, Documenta's like the Olympics, isn't it, of art. It's only every 4 or 5 years or something. Mm-hmm. And I was invited to do it 8 years ago. And I said, I just want to make a breeze in the gallery and I don't care if it's in a group show or whatever. I don't, you know, when you're in art school and you're an art student, you do the degree show. I remember this commotion about space. Everyone, oh, I wanted to be in the gallery. I want to be this space. I want that space. And everyone worries about the space and fights for the space. And I made a conscious effort, I remember, when I was an art student to not do that, to adapt and compromise to the context. So I used the entrance space and made an information kiosk. And I just thought, because it's Documenta and there's all these like top artists who are going to be fighting for attention or whatever, I should just do something that's completely ephemeral and invisible but is everywhere. And the first thing I thought of is wind does that. And wind is like a language that connects and associates everyone else's works. It passes by all these artworks. So I said that to Carolyn, the curator, and she said, great, you can have the whole ground floor of the Friedrichianum, which is the biggest, you know, that's where everyone goes at the start. And it's huge. It's like a whole museum.
How did you make the wind?
With Bonn University. Bonn University did it over 3 years. So we built two buildings outside the back of the museum. And they were soundproofed because the...
So you had like 4 years to make this then?
Yeah, yeah.
And is that the same for everyone? Or they all commissioned?
We were one of the... I was one of the earliest people to be invited.
Legend.
Yeah, that's a long list.
Yeah, I was first, yeah. But yeah, it was, I mean, it's funny because it, in the end, it's just, you walk into an empty museum and there's nothing there and there's just this breeze and you see all the invigilators have scarves on because it's so cold. And it's not like a wind tunnel. It's not like, you know, Disneyland. It's like very subtle. And then you go, oh, there's nothing here. And you read the label on the wall and it says breeze. And then you realise that even though maybe you're an arts professional and you're used to the language and everything of art, that you've missed the whole point. That it, you know, it passed you by because you weren't turned on enough and you weren't, you know, noticing enough.
Noticing again, yeah.
So, and it's it was just a good, I think it's a good work. It sort of defies being a one-liner, but it's also a work that you can explain in one line.
Got it.
I think that makes a strong idea, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Has that ever travelled anywhere else?
No, because it costs a fortune. To...
All of your work costs a fortune. It's a problem. It seems. How do you galleries. Store breeze?
Well, there's two. It was actually bought by...
Japanese?
can't say. Yeah, top secret. but yeah, the collector, I don't know if they got the turbines, but there was two huge turbines.
Got it, right, yeah.
In rooms outside with tunnels that led to the museum, so you couldn't hear any noise.
Mm-hmm.
And they drew air out the building, the front doors were left open. But for a museum of that size, we had to create a colossal vacuum. You know, the suction out the back of the building to create the breeze was immense. So the fans were huge, yeah. It was quite a... elaborate. It's funny because when people talk about it, they say, "Oh, you turn the air conditioning up."
No, it's more. Yeah, it was a bit more advanced.
Way more complex.
I wish I thought about that. Actually, it might be a lot easier. Yeah.
So every guest that comes on Talk Art, we ask them two questions, which are compulsory.
Yeah.
One is, "What is your favourite colour?"
Do you know what's funny about that?
What?
That's what me and Phil. Phil's the director of the studio. That's what we ask employees in our interviews.
Is it?
Yeah. The other one we
we're turning the tables on.
Who's
you
your
know?
Favourite artist? And if they don't say me, they don't get the job.
Yeah, fair enough. Right, that's right.
Out, get out.
Yes. Go on then. What's your favourite colour?
Well, I'm obscenely colourblind, so I don't choose any colours. So if you did a Google Images search for my work, you'll notice that the only colours that I use are primary colours or colours that can be instantly recognisable by colourblind people. And most of my work's black or grey or the colour of a material.
That's so true.
Weird, eh?
Right.
Yeah.
Is it a well-known fact that you're colourblind?
We're silent.
It is now.
Yeah, it is. It's everywhere. Right. And because they're quite institutional colours. I think you said in an interview that because of your child have been in and out of hospital, that them sort of the muted greys and the whites are play of such a big part in your artworks. Yeah.
Like an asylum.
But I'd always... I'm actually quite surprised by that because I assumed that that was a choice because it was almost like following on from conceptual art of the 70s or something where there were colour rules.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Like it was very much black and white or whatever. So I always
took it... All I can cope with.
That's so interesting.
So if I use a colour, it will be because it has to be that colour. So like the blue cubes with the ballerina series, they're always blue because blue, for me... I mean, I can talk about blue being my favourite colour because I can describe the products... cognitively of blue. So we think of Yves Klein blue or we think of...
But you can see blue.
I can see blues, yeah.
Okay.
But you think of blue and you think of the sky, so you think of depth, so you think of infinity or
the
think
sea.
Of blue screen in TV, which is unimaginable possibilities. Mm-hmm. You know, it's everything at once. So. Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned the ballerinas. They're the Degas ballerinas.
Yeah.
So what relationship have they got to being blue?
Well, that's a very good question. That should be your third question for everyone.
Degas ballerinas.
What
do with the colour blue? What?
So those works consist of three components. There's the bronze of the Degas ballerina who's exploring the world. She's been brought back to life.
Yes.
It's like Night at the Museum almost where she...
There's one of her having a fag, isn't there, smoking?
She does have, yeah. Brilliant. She has a cigarette in one of them, yeah. And she looks out the window and she hides behind the gallery desk and things like that.
Mm.
And then there's the plinth, which sort of represents the institution of art, that thing that is stigmatized, isn't it? And the elitism that we were talking about. And then there's the blue cube, and the blue cube represents contemporary art. Because when you go and see a Degas ballerina, it's you who's the viewer, the spectator, looking at her, which is the art, the spectacle. But because she's brought to life, she becomes the viewer. So I thought, if she's then the spectator, not the art, even though she's a bronze, she needs something to look at and interact with.
Right.
So what would be the most cliched stereotype of contemporary art or conceptual art? Blue cube.
Right.
If you were in a big, in a Bugs Bunny cartoon, and they were in a contemporary art gallery, Bugs, it'd be a blue cube, wouldn't it?
Good one.
Makes total sense.
Yeah.
I can't, yeah, to you.
No, I get it.
I'm trying to piece it. I'm thinking of the Bugs Bunny art gallery. Oh. What I would do, I'd just put a carrot in there, like a bronze carrot.
Oh.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Maybe you're an artist too now, Rob.
Maybe.
All these years.
I'm creative.
You are, I'm proud of you.
Let's share studios.
Exactly.
And our next question is, if you could art heist something, take it home with you, your touchstone work of art that would be just yours forever, what would it be?
My God. God, that's impossible.
Really? Do you think so?
God, one thing.
What, is there an art gallery you go to and you see, you go back to again and again, like, and again, for, and look at something?
For example, my one is my Frida Kahlo. So, like, I was obsessed with Frida. If I could actually steal a painting, I would love to have, like, My Birth by Frida Kahlo, even though it's a really
intense
one.
Mine's a painting by Picasso called Night Fishing at Antibes that's in the MoMA.
This is really telling, actually. It tells me something about myself that I've never thought about, but I guess that I'm not... I don't really like art when it's finished.
Yeah, you don't.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. So you, well, whose story do you want? What's the legacy, like... Whose story would
you know
like
what
to
I'd probably
continue?
Have? I'd probably have, you know, the Pierre Huet work where he sands the wall and all the rings are the coloured paint underneath?
Yes.
I'd have something like that.
Love that work.
Because it doesn't last, does it? It extinguishes itself, or he has to come and sand your wall, or I don't know. It's more about it, because it's already there, that work. You know, if you did it in your house, it's all the layers of paint that are on the wall.
Yeah.
And you get these coloured rings where he sands it away.
So basically, when you sand down the walrus, it reveals all the layers of paint.
Of time.
Underneath.
Yeah, it's a bit
so
like
it's great in
a
museum.
A time capsule.
Yeah, they're amazing, those.
Or ones. Like, you know, when you cut a tree and you count the rings.
Yes.
It's a bit like that.
I'm always cutting trees and counting the rings. But that's like a bit, same time capsule. That relates to your work and the fact that when I looked at these dens that you've cast in marble, that is like a time capsule. That's kind of freezing time of your kid's development. Yeah. Your kid's like...
Yeah, totally.
Well, the funny thing about that is I kept making them because kids keep making dens. It's just like an instinctive thing that all kids do, I think. Mm-hmm. Make shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And they changed, but they changed in scale as the kids got bigger physically.
Mm-hmm.
But they also changed as they got more intelligent. They became more elaborate, more architectural.
And the security system.
Exactly. 3D printing them.
Yeah, 3D printing dens. Yeah. But you're talking about, have you ever heard the sandcastle effect, which is, I don't know why I'm going northern than that, sandcastle effect, which is... about the creative mind, and it's about kids and about the fact that all kids make sandcastles. So all kids make sandcastles and they build a sandcastle, which means that you're creative because you're an architect. You're building these and you might place them all over the place. Then you might decorate them with shells. So when you decorate them with shells, that means you're an artist or you're a designer or you're a decorator. Yeah. You do that. And then you might create these characters, the princess or the prince like being rescued by the princess. Let's just do that. And suddenly you're a storyteller or you're an actor.
Yeah.
And that all stems, everyone has the ability to access all creativity at that age.
Yeah. Wow.
And if you just look at kids playing a sandcastle, you can normally see what sort of like persuasion where they're leaning towards.
Yeah.
And I think that's an incredible thing. And I think what you're saying about the dens, it kind of relates to me on that level.
Could I say something provocative?
Yeah, go on.
I'd say that the first bit, building the sandcastle, is a cognitive activity. It's your brain. And I'd say that the third one, the storytelling, the narration, is a cognitive activity. But I'd say it's going to get loads of letters.
Go on.
You get comments on your... Gonna get loads of comments about it.
Slag,
come on, right in.
Do it.
Number two is a retinal one. It's the eyes only.
Really?
I'd say.
At that age?
No, at any age.
Wow.
Decoration.
Huh. So nothing's really real. Got it.
Do you see what I mean though?
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
It's interesting because
you've squashed my kind of
I like the sandcastle pyramid effect thingy.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
But no, I think the point is that I'm getting at is you know, the art world's changing. We're seeing it change. And you look at Instagram and we look at art that becomes popularized by Instagram and others, you know, visual platforms, social platforms. And it's often, I mean, I'm seeing this develop. I've just been doing a program for the BBC that touches on this, the way our self idea of self changes by social media. But I think what we're seeing is two types of art emerge, an art that is based in cognitive, mental, the brain, and another type which is retinal only. It visually has strong, bold, visually striking characteristics, which function dead well on social media. But it feels like they're moving apart. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
It feels like the gulf between those two worlds is
cognitive
increasing.
And retinal.
Yeah.
And as an artist, they used to be connected more.
Absolutely. I'd say so, yeah. I think so. I don't know if you've thought about this.
But I've never thought about that.
I've just been thinking about it the last 3 months, but it feels like, yeah, things are moving, changing, the art world's changing somehow.
No, that's definitely happening. Yeah, but I don't think I'd explained it in the way that you just have.
How would you explain it?
I don't know. I mean, I've been seeing it as the art world changing in more of a physical space idea, and you know, the fact we're moving to Margate, and the fact that people weren't visiting exhibitions as much anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, for example, we went around galleries the other weekend, and that all the galleries are empty on Saturday. And there's this myth that like all the big galleries are busy all the time, but they're not. Unless you're Tracy Emin, who's getting 10,000 visitors a day on the weekend. You know, superstar artists get these shows where people will visit, or big museums get them. But I think commercial galleries don't get the visitors they used to get, because a lot of people are just getting into the idea of looking on the internet, feel like they've been to the exhibition without being to it, without visiting it in real life, which is really problematic.
See, the thing is, the danger with that is, how would you experience a work like my wind piece, breeze piece, through Instagram?
You
don't go to the physical space. And you don't feel it, and you don't.
I guess it would be through words. You know,
it'd be a photo of the IG video of someone, like, with hair blowing.
Yeah. That's true, yeah. But the point is, though,
to make a video that it looks rubbish.
But I think, though, that people want... one of the reasons we're doing Margate is that it's going to give people an experience. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of leading them to the gallery by saying, come to Margate for the day, come and have an experience day out, as a way of getting people to come. Because when we were in Shoreditch, it just felt... I mean, even I was kind of bored sitting at the desk, you know. Yeah. It's just not exciting anymore. Yeah. So I think we're trying to work out a way of getting a bigger space so we can do more adventurous exhibitions, but get people physically there, even though it's not a destination in London. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And we went to Hauser & Wirth in Bruton recently, and we had this experience. We saw Calder's, rattles that he'd made for his kid and all of these, you know, things. But that was a real day out and an experience.
It's nice there.
You would have loved that.
I was in a show and they put us in the farmhouse.
Amazing, my God.
It's like luxury.
We were staying in the town in one of their houses. It was so beautiful. But that was an experience. And then you take it away with you and it's a memory. And I don't know. So I think that's probably the way it's going to end up going. Well, look, when is that documentary out?
Is this my trying to sell, get viewing figures in? So it's on. It's probably, this will be after, won't it?
I don't know. We can.
This is the 18th. It's on the 18th.
Maybe we'll bump
you
up. No, but I'm sure it'll be on iPlayer.
Yeah, probably will. It goes on BBC World after, I think. So.
Okay, great.
And it's on BBC Four.
And what's the title of the show?
It's called Me, Myself, and I, with Ryan Gander. The with Ryan Gander, I was a bit annoyed about, because it makes me sound like Bob Holness on Blockbuster. With Ryan Gander. I just say, can't you just call it Ryan Gander? The self. Or something.
Yeah.
Me, myself, and I.
I didn't do that.
That wasn't your pun.
Actually takes me back to your Miranda Sawyer interview, because when she talked about your thinker rock, she did a pose and she was like, oh, hang on, that's not
Bruce
the thinker.
Forsyth.
It's Bruce Forsyth. I love her. I think she's brilliant. Look, we're looking forward to seeing the new documentary. And for everybody who isn't familiar, please Google Ryan Gander on YouTube and you can watch many different series.
You've got an Instagram, haven't you?
Yeah.
What's your Instagram?
It's Ryan J. Gander.
What's the J stand for?
James.
No, not Paul.
James.
Oh, not conceptual. It's not a conceptual
name. No,
joke.
It's just someone took Ryan Gander.
Boring.
Ice hockey player in Canada.
Maybe don't Google him. We're going to Google Ryan Gander artist.
Yes.
And our Instagram at Talk Art will have images of all the artworks we've discussed today.
Yeah.
And see you all very soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming in.
Great to spend time with you.
Of course.
Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.